one thing that I remember hearing that is super not helpful is when people tell you, well, when you stop looking, that's when you'll find them. And I mean, that is just a trap. Like, that's, how could you stop looking?
And so, just using very basic game theory, I wrote down every girl's name.
I wrote down every guy's name.
Because this way I would know who I matched with. But funny enough, I wasn't matched with Lindsay. So, and
we think it was an error.
We think it was an error. So I actually messengered her and said, hey, you know, I picked you. Why didn't you pick me? I thought we really hit it off. And she, of course, said, oh, I picked you also. But that's how we started dating. There's an acceptance of who that person is deep down. But there's also an expectation that, like, they requalify. And I want to requalify to be Lindsay's husband next year. To do that, I have to, there has to be some growth. And I can't just show up the way I do now. And I think, I don't say that as a chore. I say that as a, maybe as a romantic challenge.
In this episode of Modern Relationships, Eric sits down with Harley Finkelstein and Lindsay Tobe, who have been together for 15 years. Harley is the president of Shopify, and Lindsay is a psychotherapist and entrepreneur, and together they're raising two daughters. Up ahead, they talk about their speed dating origin story, balancing radical acceptance with personal growth, and how to think about work-life balance when your job is all-consuming. Before we get to today's episode, please note, this information is for general educational purposes only and is not a recommendation to buy, hold, or sell any investment or financial product. Turpentine is an acquisition of A16Z Holdings LLC and is not a bank, investment advisor, or broker-dealer. This podcast includes paid promotional advertisements, and individuals and companies featured or advertised during this podcast are not endorsing AH Capital or any of its affiliates, including but not limited to A16Z Perennial Management LP. Similarly, Turpentine is not endorsing affiliates, individuals, or any entities featured on this podcast. All investments involve risk, including the possible loss of capital. Past performance is no guarantee of future results, and the opinions presented cannot be viewed as an indicator of future performance. Before making decisions with legal, tax, or accounting effects, you should consult appropriate professionals. Information is from sources deemed reliable on the date of publication, but Turpentine does not guarantee its accuracy. Now let's get started.
Lindsay, Harley, welcome to the podcast.
We are very grateful to be here.
Thanks for having us.
We don't do a lot of these podcasts together as a couple, so this is kind of fun.
Amazing. So the conceit of this podcast is basically about learning from great couples such as yourself about how to find an amazing life partner and how to build an amazing life partnership. So let's start with that first question and maybe get into your story of how you guys found each other and what other people can learn about how to find a great life partner.
Well, I can start the story. So Harley and I, we sort of had overlapping circles growing up, but we didn't know each other. And where we really connected was at a very unusual place. It was at a speed dating event, which honestly, neither of us, I don't think, ever thought that we would go to speed dating. But it just so happened that we were both there and we met and we were like, hey, we know each other, kind of. Yeah, ha, ha, ha. And yeah, that's how it started.
Eric, that's a story we have not really told anyone publicly before. So you are getting the goods because we don't share that a lot. But actually, what's interesting is that the way that speed dating works is if each person picks one another, then the speed dating organizers connect you. And so just using very basic game theory, I wrote down every girl's name.
I wrote down every guy's name.
Because this way I would know who I matched with. But funny enough, I wasn't matched with Lindsay. So, and
we think it was an error.
We think it was an error. I mean, this is literally, I don't know, 15 years ago at this point, maybe more than that. So I actually called Lindsay, or texted her, I think. Actually, I think it was Facebook Messenger. That's how long ago it was. I Facebook Messengered her and said, hey, like, what the you know, I picked you. Why didn't you pick me? I thought we really hit it off. And she, of course, said, oh, I picked you also. But that's how we started dating.
And was it smooth sailing from there? Or, yeah, what happened after that?
Well, I think, you know, life was sort of bringing us to different places at that point. I was finishing grad school in Ottawa And Harley had accepted an articling position in Toronto. And so he kind of told me right off the bat, like, hey, you know, I don't think this is going to work because we're not going to be living in the same city. And so I was like, oh, I was like, okay, fine. But then we still hung out a ton anyway and still had a lot of fun together. And then eventually Harley was like, well, you'll come visit me in Toronto, I guess. And I was like, maybe I will, maybe I won't, but I did.
I think part of those early, I mean, obviously when you're first dating anyone, you bring a lot of baggage from previous relationships, from previous experiences. I had been in a serious relationship throughout most of law school before I met Lindsay. And so this idea of getting back into another serious relationship felt kind of like the wrong thing to do. And it had nothing to do with Lindsay at all. It was just my own baggage that I brought in. And it seems to me that there's this threshold, this particular point that happens where the dating gets to a level where you're willing to effectively, you know, clean slate all your past relationships. Like, it doesn't matter that I just came from a long-term relationship, that like the dynamic and the connection with Lindsay was so strong that I was like, whatever happened before is sort of non-consequential. And I obviously, there's a spark here. There's something here. We should kind of figure a way to make it work. But we effectively started our relationship with me saying, I'm going to be moving in a couple of months from now to Toronto to article. And I don't know how that, like, you know, starting a relationship in a long distance model is not always ideal. But it ended up that I moved to Toronto to article, had the worst year of my life. Anyone, I mean, you know me a little, Eric, but anyone that knows me that's watching knows that I am, you know, I've been an entrepreneur my entire life, and working at a law firm, no matter how much money they were paying me, was like the worst thing in the world. I never wanted to be a lawyer. I went to law school to become a better entrepreneur. But the silver lining of my article experience was, one, at that point, I'd already known that there's no way I was going to be a lawyer, that I wanted to go back to entrepreneurship. And I was already sort of pitching Toby at the time to let me join Shopify. And it was him and basically three other engineers at the time. So one, it was that I found the thing that would become my life's work. And second, I found the thing that would become my life's partner, which is Lindsay. But
I don't think we knew that right off the bat. I think we just both knew there was something there and we wanted to put in the work and figure things out, even though it was like we were in two different cities and he was just coming out of a relationship. And there were all these things that sort of suggested maybe this is not right, but we were both willing to give it a shot. And I mean, my experience before you was, you know, I didn't think I'd ever meet anyone. I was like, I'm so old. I'm never going to meet the right person. I was 25 when I met Harley, which is so ridiculous, like saying that now, you know, believing that, oh, I'm 25. It's too late for me. I'm never going to meet the right person. And I really felt that. I felt that for a long time before I met Harley. I dated other people and nobody was right. And so I think it left me a little bit jaded that even when we started dating, I was like, yeah, he's moving, of course, like another one that's not right, you know, big surprise. But then it actually was a surprise because it worked out.
When did you guys know that, hey, this is long term, this is going to work, we're going to make it happen?
So articles are 10 months. And by like month three into the 10 month article experience, just for those that are watching in the US, so I think you have something similar to this in the US, but in Canada, before you get called to the bar to officially be a lawyer, you spend 10 months working at a law firm. And in my case, I was working at a fairly large, you know, corporate finance law firm. On the side, nights and weekends, I was like running my online store on Shopify. Lindsay was coming to see me in Toronto every weekend. But at that point, it was clear to me that I was going to move back to Ottawa, join Toby and Daniel and Cody, the original kind of three people that built Shopify, that founded Shopify. And I was going to move to Ottawa. And I remember saying to Lindsay, I'm going to move back to Ottawa. I'm going to get an apartment there. You should get an apartment there as well. Yeah. And she basically said, like,
absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Like, if she's going to stay in Ottawa, because she'd finished school at that point, if she's going to stay in
Ottawa. And I was planning to move back to Montreal at that point. I was like, okay, I've done my time in Ottawa. I got my degree. I'm going to move back to Montreal. And then he comes along. He's like, I'm going to move back to Ottawa, but, you know, get
you
your own
stay
place.
There too. And I think, she, you know, too, and this is.
Maybe, and we'd been dating for a year already at that point. So that seemed absurd.
And maybe this is just a good lesson for people that are in sort of early relationships. But she's like, no, she's like, if this is getting serious, you need to also have, you need to show me that you're serious too. It can't be a relationship of convenience. And I remember thinking about it. I was like, well, like, I'm not willing to lose Lindsay. I didn't necessarily think that we were going to move in together yet, but you know, this feels like this can go somewhere. And
those were the circumstances. It didn't make sense for me to find my own place when you were getting a place. And I remember actually the day that we went to look at condos to rent, and it was like a rainy day. And at that point, I still wasn't even sure that I'd be living with you, but I was still, you know, I was coming along and trying to be really extra helpful and, you know, like showing like, hey, like, this is the right thing for us. We should be living in this place together. And
but
I guess it worked.
But to your exact point, I don't remember the exact moment where, at least from my perspective, I realized that this was going to work. But I do remember that. Remember, like, you're now kind of seeing us, you know, we've been married now since 2013. So married for 12 years. We've been dating now. So we've been together pretty much for 15 or 16 years. I'm celebrating my 16th year at Shopify at this point. You're sort of seeing the highlight reel, I think, of our relationship. But if you sort of go back to that moment where we decided to move in together, I had been grinding most of my life. I was, you know, I was born in Canada. I grew up in South Florida. I ended up starting a t-shirt business in college, went to law school to become a better entrepreneur. I didn't have any money. I was paying my tuition. I was helping my family support, helping my mom and younger sisters. My life was a little bit unclear. I knew that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I knew that that was something that I felt that that was going to be some version of that was going to be my life's work. But no one, I didn't have any money. I didn't necessarily have any big vision. This idea of Shopify, I think when I pitched it to Lindsay that I'm going to go join Toby, who she may have met once or twice at that point in Ottawa, Canada, which again, like, we're not from there. I didn't grow up there. It's not exactly Silicon Valley or Miami or San Francisco or New York. The fact that Lindsay was willing to take a chance on me at that point, I thought was very telling. And I'll foreshadow a little bit what I think we'll talk about later on in this discussion. But I actually think more and more that the best relationships that we try to emulate, that we admire, this is going to sound somewhat transactional, but it's not. It's actually, I think, a beautiful and a romantic thing. The best relationships, I think, are true partnerships. And what I mean by that is someone presents their vision of a life to the other, and the other person kind of jumps on board of that journey. Doesn't mean they don't have their own journey or their own vision. Lindsay has her own life. She has her own career. She has her own, you know, life's work as well that is separate from mine, from my life. But Lindsay was willing to close her eyes and kind of jump on this journey that I tried to articulate for the both of us. And it meant move to Ottawa, this random city, work for this brilliant, crazy German programmer who was trying to, you know, build e-commerce software for SMBs. And she was in. She was in for the ride. And I remember at that moment thinking that this has all the makings of what might be a very long-term partnership. I didn't realize our life would turn out this way. Certainly, I never could have imagined any of this would have been possible. I don't think you could have either, that our life would be like this. But she was kind of ride or die from the get-go.
Yeah, that kind of loyalty is hard to prove without actually doing it.
We'll get right back to the conversation after a word from our sponsors. Modern Relationships is sponsored by Relationship Hero, your personal relationship coach. It's an open secret in Silicon Valley that people are using these relationship coaches. Over 100,000 users are happy they tried Relationship Hero. You might be wondering, what is it like to talk to a relationship coach? Well, here's Jackie Pugh, a senior coach at Relationship Hero.
That's a really good question. Okay, I actually just got off a call with a client who was getting mixed signals from his ex. So she's the one that broke up with him, but then she kept sending him these really heartfelt, long, emotional messages at midnight, and then in the morning would act like nothing ever happened.
We've all been there. How do you recommend handling something like that?
So what we would do is we would want to hear exactly what's going on so we can help discern, is my client's ex, is she just trying to process her emotions and she's doing it via text message? Is she potentially trying to keep my client on the back burner? Or is she actually trying to reconnect? And if she is, then I help my client decide, you know, is this something that he actually wants to do, reconnect? And if so, why?
Thanks, Jackie. If you want to try your first one-on-one or couples coaching session, go to relationshiphero.com/modern. You'll get $50 off your first session if you use our link. Again, that's relationshiphero.com/modern.
You know, you guys met each other at the beginning of your journeys. You know, imagine if you were single now after the Shopify success. It would look very different. Both have friends who've been successful and they don't know you. Do people really like them? You know, by being together for 15 plus years, you have that group, you have that loyalty that you guys.
It's so interesting you say that. So every once a month we do town hall at Shopify, and I don't want to make this about Shopify, but we do town hall. And we just recorded our town hall, and we have an internal podcast at Shopify called Context. I don't need to go into the details of it, but we just did our 100th episode of Context. And so I did a bit of a review. Tobin did a review of like all our Context episodes we've done. And I picked up a couple from like episode 2 and episode 4 and 47 and 69, you know, all these different episodes. And like I randomly did a bit of like a mashup, like a supercut of them. And one of the episodes that I showed Toby was the episode where I interviewed Fiona, I interviewed his wife. And Fiona talks about how they actually met playing a video game, like literally in the video game in 1999, I believe it was. And it sort of got us on a little bit of a conversation that everyone that was Shopify was able to see now, which was about how it is remarkable that early team, the very early team of Shopify, all of us were in these amazing relationships. And the question that we sort of posed to ourselves was, could we have built this thing, which is now, you know, this huge multinational, publicly traded $100 billion company that has, you know, had a major impact without the support of Lindsay for me and Fiona for Toby? And the answer was no, that there's no way we could have done it. That knowing that we had some stability in our life, in our personal life, allowed us to take these very big swings, very big chances in our professional lives, that we were okay with taking big bets with Shopify because we knew ultimately we had this incredible support system. And to your point, Eric, I agree with you. I think that because of when Lindsay and I got together, the success that we've enjoyed feels like our success, not my success or her success. It feels like it is our success, that she's a huge part of the Shopify journey, just like Toby's wife Fiona is as well. She remembers when we couldn't cover payroll. She remembers like pre-Series A when we couldn't, you know, we were worried about funding and we're into the next quarter, the next month.
And I remember what your original bathroom looked like and building, and, you know,
it was really bad.
Glamorous.
It was totally unglamorous.
It was fun and it was exciting, but it definitely wasn't glamorous.
But I think that is a very... I don't know, maybe that's serendipitous. I don't think you can plan that properly, but I think you are very fortunate if you were able to meet your partner in life at a point where you were able to share, not just in the upside and sort of the success of it, but also in the come up of it, of the journey of it, because like it's important, at least for me, that it feels like we have done this together.
And we're still doing it together, because, you know, if you think about a relationship, it's not like you reach a certain point and you're like, okay, we're good now, because relationships change and evolve so much. And we each change and evolve so much. That's just the way life goes. There's different seasons. There's different periods. There's different chapters. There's all these things that, you know, there's circumstances, like all these things happen, and some of them you control. Like you choose to get married, you choose to have kids, you know, these are choices that you make. They don't always go smoothly, maybe, but I think in the process we're growing and we're changing. And I think it's really important to always, you know, remember to, I don't want to say prioritize your relationship. That's not exactly the word I'm looking for, but to just always, you know, not to take it for granted, right? Like it's always work, and the work is worth it. And I think we're both happy to do it, but at no point am I like, okay, like I'm done now, you know, like it's always continued growth.
Yeah, we have a bunch learning. Of, we made this interesting topic. We have a bunch of role models in our life, different buckets. So we have like, I maybe have said this to you on previous interviews, but you know, I have a mentor in my life for building like a company the size of Shopify. And I have a mentor in my life who I really want to, I think he's a wonderful father, and I've emulated sort of his style of parenting. We also have relationship couples in our lives as well who we look at, and again, we don't know everything that goes on behind closed doors, but we have a pretty good sense of how they've kind of gone on this journey for, you know, good times and bad times together. And we've learned a lot from them. But actually our ultimate relationship role model are my grandparents, who are in their 90s, and they've been married for 75 years. And what is remarkable is that 75 years of marriage, they're in their 90s. So, you know, they've been ride or die for a very, very long time. My grandfather will still go on a random Tuesday to go buy my grandmother flowers, and they will still take a drive. This is so crazy, but my grandfather went out and bought himself a little convertible last year, 2 years ago. And they'll take these drives, like, you know, south of the border. We live in Canada, so they'll drive to like Vermont to buy a particular cheese that they really love. And you'll ask them, like, why are you, like, you're 93, why are you driving 3 hours for cheese? And part of it is they like the cheese, but part of it is that it gives them this sort of date, like it's a date for them. And so we've emulated that. Lindsay and I, you know, last Thursday, like we try to have date nights a lot. We go for a great dinner, an amazing restaurant. We're not really sports people, but we have tickets to the Montreal Canadiens, the hockey team. So we're just going to see the hockey game. We've stayed for all of, I don't know, 6 minutes because we're not really hockey fans, but we plan these things, and we're emulating what my grandparents have done because, frankly, we think they've done it better than anybody.
Yeah. That's amazing. What else have you learned from other couples or sought to emulate from the couples you admire?
Well, I think every relationship is different. And, you know, there's certain things that might work for one relationship that don't work for another. One example I could give is, you know, Harley travels a ton. I think a lot of people would not be okay with that. I have figured out how to manage with that. So, you know, that's something that works for us but doesn't work for others. When I look at some of the other couples that I can see are in really good relationships, one of the things that's obvious to me is that they still look at each other like it's, you know, like they're still getting to know each other. You know, like it's not boring to spend time with their partner because there's always surprises. And, you know, your partner might say things that you don't expect, or sometimes they say exactly what you expect, but there's beauty in that too. And so, yeah, I think that's one thing that I've observed for sure.
I mean, Lindsay is a psychotherapist. I think that's incredibly helpful. Not to say that like everyone who's watching who's single should go and marry a psychotherapist, but I can tell you that someone that has a background in therapy is very valuable because she has nomenclature for things. She'll say, I think you're feeling this, therefore we should try, like, here's an interesting technique. That has been a wonderful hack. And as part of that, we've seen a couples therapist for a long time, and we sort of go in and out on it every now and then. I take over the therapist just for me. The couples therapist would be like, I need some time alone with Harley. She usually doesn't say she needs time alone with Lindsay, but this idea of a couples therapist also is really great. Something that we learned from another couple friend that we have. And it felt a little bit like, you know, the famous maxim of the best time to go to the gym is before you like need to go to the gym. Like you should go to the gym before you're overweight and out of shape. The couples therapist is this great tool that we can sort of implement every now and then when we feel like we're doing something or we're just not connecting in the right way over an extended period of time. We will like reach into that toolbox and say, all right, it's time to go talk to Catherine, our couples therapist, and we'll go meet Catherine. We'll have it out. We'll have a facilitator to it. That, I think, is something that most people view as something they do after they go too far, where it's so bad, it's so negative, there's so much tension. And actually, I think that that's a wonderful way to do it. Another thing that I have found to be, actually, I've never even told you this, but this is so maybe, I don't know, nerdy or something or weird or cringe, but, you know, once a quarter, I have earnings calls. And that's sort of like, you know, part of my role at Shopify is to be like the chief storyteller. But earnings is like the moment for me to storytell to Wall Street, to the media, to consumers, to merchants, to everyone in the world about how Shopify is doing. And it's really stressful. I mean, every word needs to be chosen properly. Every voice inflection is noted. Every hesitation is written up in some analyst report. Things like there's a lot of weight to it. And I feel the weight of that. And one of the things that I don't know if you do this, you know, if this comes easy or you put a lot of time and attention to it. But I sort of feel like the week coming into earnings, it feels like Lynn's and our daughters, like everyone knows it's earnings week. And it's not like leave Harley alone or leave dad alone because it's earnings week. It's actually way more supportive of that. It's like, you know, like Lynn's makes a special meal the night before earnings for me. Like it's more of a quiet night in the house. It feels like we're team Harley and Lindsay. It feels like we're team Lindsay and Harley. It doesn't feel like I'm on my journey and she's on hers and like we can have our own lives. It feels like when the stakes are really high, I feel this level of support that like the Finkelstein family has Q2 earnings. And that type of support system, it sort of goes back to those early days of when we were just building Shopify, that like we were able to take big risks because we felt we had the support system at home. I feel that now. I feel like it's Lynn's and I versus the world. And like, we are going to fight together to win whatever winning means in that way.
That's amazing. I love that. I want to get to the to some of the advice portion of the, of this interview. First, I'll start with the finding a partner. The finding a partner, what have you found when you talk to your friends who are looking or giving advice? What have you found is particularly helpful or find mistakes that they typically make?
I think one thing that I remember hearing that is super not helpful is when people tell you, well, when you stop looking, that's when you'll find them. And I mean, that is just a trap. Like that's, how could you stop looking? I mean, maybe if you're putting a lot of pressure on yourself, having awareness of that and dialing it back, sure. But if you really want to find someone to spend the rest of your life with, I don't think that you could ever just, you know, stop looking. I think that that was advice that used to frustrate me a lot when I was younger.
I think,
yeah, what about you?
I think there are, you know, we don't do this because maybe, I don't know, I like to have a certain level of like emotion and romance in our relationship and our marriage. And I find this makes things a little bit more too, I don't know, transactional. I know some people do like family, you know, like they'll have like board of director meetings for their family where they'll sit down and they'll talk about their goals for the quarter. We don't do that. It's sort of, ours is kind of always on. But one of the things I do think that proper communication, maybe this sort of, you know, like relationship meetings, whatever your version that might be, is helpful to do is, I think it's important that, especially in the early stages of these relationships, that you do share like, what does winning look like to you in your life? I think that if Lynn's wouldn't have known, or she wouldn't have, if I wouldn't have provided her by preview to her where I'd like my life to be in 10, 20, 30 years, I'm not sure surprising her would be very good. I'm not sure that would have been, I don't know. I'm not sure that would have been a very good strategy. I think I work a lot. I work 60 hours a week. I have a plan to work. You know, my craft is very important to me. We have some friends that where it felt at some stage they were surprised to learn that, oh, like at some point when they turn 40, one of them wants to live in Europe and the other does not. Or one of them absolutely unequivocally never wants to have kids and the other one does. I think that actually is a recipe for not necessarily divorce or a lack of a strong relationship, but certainly it's a recipe for tension. And I think being, you know, however you do it, you can write it out, you can discuss it out, but leaving breadcrumbs for your partner at any stage, someone you just met that you're dating, you feel like things are going somewhere, or a longer term relationship, leading breadcrumbs up to follow, I think can be incredibly valuable.
And it has to be breadcrumbs because I think, you know, particularly at the early stages of a relationship, if one person says to the other, hey, I want to have kids, the other person, if they're not thinking that way, that might send them running for the hills. And that doesn't mean that they don't want to have kids together. But I think it's just about approaching that very carefully and gently. And I agree, you should be upfront about that as early as you can be, because there's no point going down a road with someone if eventually you're going to want to go down two different paths. That's just not going to work.
Yeah. A couple hacks also that I think have worked really well for us that we didn't plan but worked well is that it turns out that our best friends, like our best couple friends, the ones we travel with, the ones that we, you know, do everything with. We have, you know, it's Passover's coming up, the Jewish holiday. So like night one, we do with our families, but night two, it's sort of friends that we invite over to celebrate Jewish holidays with. So the people like are our best friends in our lives. It turns out that my relationship with like one of them is very strong, and Lindsay's relationship with the other one is also very strong. We have friends, Jeremy and Rachel. Lynn's has been super close with Rachel for most of her life. Jeremy's been my best friend since I was 4 years old. So that actually creates this wonderful dynamic. And I think, again, I'm not sure you can plan for them, but that's been really, really valuable. And I think there's one other thing I sort of thought about that also would be helpful. Oh, when we got married, we had this conversation about, we'd gone to this thing called Summit Series or Summit, which is sort of, I don't know if you know it, Eric, but it's pretty cool. You know, yeah. So Lindsay and I went to Summit when we were dating together, which is a really cool thing, because Summit's all about like personal growth and finding your life's work and all that. But one of the sessions we did at Summit, I don't remember who it was, but it talked about energy vampires in your life. And so we came back from Summit, we're like, let's diarize. Let's like make a list of the people in our lives that give us energy and those that sort of act as energy vampires. And we sort of together had a discussion around like, and frankly, some of these people, like some of the energy vampires in our life were people that were like family members. And, you know, we had to sort of tone down or downshift our relationship with them because we were our own journeys of trying to build this wonderful life together and for ourselves. And actually having a conversation around like, these are people we want to spend more time on because they give us great energy. And these are people we want to spend less time on or less time with because they suck the energy from us. And having that discussion together, I thought that was a really valuable tactic.
Another thing, another, you know, piece of advice I would give to somebody looking to get into a relationship is it's good to know what you want, but don't be stuck on it. Because sometimes if you have a really strict list of criteria that your partner must have, and then somebody doesn't have some of the criteria, you might be missing out on a really incredible person. But at the same time, you don't want to compromise your values and your beliefs. So it's important to have a balance there.
Or even like, I don't go to speed dating. I just don't do speed dating. And the one time that Lindsay and I both went to speed dating, we met each other.
Exactly. Did you guys have a list of criteria when you were 25, or were you kind of more open-minded as to what you might find? Or did you guys meet the idea of what you thought you would find?
I don't think I had a list of criteria. I think I was pretty open-minded. And for me, like, I really rely on my intuition a lot. So I pay attention to how I feel when I'm with a person. Like, do I like how I'm feeling right now? Or do I not like how I'm feeling? You know, did that particular thing that happened, like, how did that make me feel? And, you know, is that okay? Is it not okay? Just really, really paying attention to that. And that takes time. I think sometimes when you meet a person, you kind of know right away if you don't connect with them. But at other times, you might meet a person and you're not sure. And I think if you're not sure, definitely try it out. And then sometimes you're absolutely sure. You're like, this is great. But the other person might not share that. So, you know, no guarantees.
We have a family motto now that I share from time to time. It feels like the appropriate time to share, which is how you do anything is how you do everything. And you've heard this, obviously, this rhetoric or this line before. It's nothing that we created, but it really resonates with Linz and I, and particularly because it speaks about intentionality. And I don't think I had a list of criteria, but I remember you came to my apartment that I had when I was in school, when I was in law school. It was in a very nice apartment. But I remember
it was pretty nice.
It was okay. I had a little bit of t-shirt money, but not much. For a student, I think it was okay. But I remember you coming to my house and it would just be a random night, like a Wednesday night or Tuesday night or something. And the intentionality you used, you do the same thing now, but the way you made dinner, for example, the thoughtfulness, like you showed me the particular tomatoes and your left, the way you cut the tomatoes, right? Like, you cared about that. In fact, you cared a lot about like how you slice tomatoes. There's a as now people know, like
you should use a serrated.
Yeah, there's a way to cut tomatoes. But I remember thinking that the intentionality she'd use to cut these tomatoes and to purchase tomatoes from a particular farmer and the way they were presented, like it wasn't a special celebration. It wasn't fancy. We were in our early 20s. We were, you know, fairly like lower, like middle class students at this time. but she cared a lot.
Well, life's too short to eat the wrong tomatoes, and your grandparents would agree.
Yes.
Actually, as tomato lovers, as fellow tomato lovers.
They would, but they would actually, but they were not, and I actually, that was it. That was one of those, obviously, you know, like you have to have physical connection and intellectual connection, but she took care of this task for us the same way that I was taking care of my task for us, which in my case was like selling t-shirts so I can pay for my tuition. I think that Venn diagram overlap of intentionality has been the Venn diagram overlap of our entire lives. It's how we live our lives now. It's how we think about, you know, our family and raising our kids with intentionality. And I just posted this on Instagram earlier this week, but we're doing this thing with our kids, trying to teach them about charity and philanthropy. And Lindsay and I sort of use a model of philanthropy that I learned from David Rubenstein and Peter May called entrepreneurial philanthropy or savage philanthropy, which is like, forget about how philanthropy is supposed to be done. Focus on impact. Don't necessarily spray and pray that your money's going to the right place, but pick one thing.
Have a plan.
Have a plan. Pick one thing you can change that has an obvious solution. Fund that one thing and show real efficacy and efficiency of that impact. So we're teaching our kids that now. And that's been the thing that we were excited to teach our 6-year-old and our 8-year-old about. And now once a month, each of our daughters has to pick a charity. They get $20 and they get to research the charity. They get to explain to us and pitch us on why that charity matters. And then they get to go and actually deliver the money to the charity. And from time to time, Lindsay and I will obviously go and make a larger donation ourselves to it. But the way you do anything is the way you do everything. And we've sort of been using that model since we first met.
That's amazing. I want to talk more about the financial side of things, because anyone who meets someone in their 20s, you know, is going to be in a very different financial situation than in their 40s. And you guys met on the beginning of your journey. Now you're in a very different position. So how have you guys evolved and how you thought about sort of money as it relates to how you guys want to live, how you want to raise your family? There are all sorts of questions around kids and money. What is your philosophy around money for other people or other, you know, parents or people who are thinking about, hey, how should I think about this?
I think, you know, we're incredibly blessed and I feel lucky for everything that we have. I think we said this earlier. I had no idea that this is how my life would be. Like I guess it's kind of like that list of criteria. Like I didn't have a list of criteria for how my life would go. And I think, you know, when it comes to money, I mean, that's a very broad sort of topic, but I think, you know, I'll tackle the with kids part. I don't want my kids to be spoiled brats. I want my kids to be appreciative of everything. And I want them to understand the value that money has. And, you know, kids, they ask for millions of things. They want everything under the sun. And, you know, we could say yes to everything, but we don't, because I don't want my kids to have the expectation that I can just ask for something and get it. Like there's things to think about. And it's not just about being able to afford the things. It's, you know, understanding that, no, we're not buying that because you already have a caboodle. I don't know if everyone out there knows what a caboodle is, but it's this thing. It's kind of like a toolbox for kids and it has this little clip on it and they make them in really fun colors. And my daughter last week was like, I want a new caboodle. And I just bought her one for summer camp last summer. And so I said, why do you need a new caboodle? She said, well, I like the colors of this one better. And I was like, no, like your other caboodle is fine. This is exactly the same caboodle. You're not getting a bigger one. Like it's the same. It's like, you know, you need to be okay with what you have.
I mean, this is why our relationship works, because I'd be like, it's $50. Like,
oh, it's less than that. It's like $27.
I mean, I think that stuff's important. Look, we get a chance to stay at like the most beautiful hotels, the most amazing cities. And every time we walk in there, Lindsay pulls the girls aside. Our daughters are Bailey and Zoe. And she'll pull them aside and say, okay, this is a really nice hotel. And this is a very special place. And the reason we're here is because like we work really, really hard to be here. This is not normal. Like most people don't get a chance to stay here. And I think what that's built in our kids is a sense of appreciation and gratitude. But look, like just to say the thing, I kind of wish my kids were born pre-IPO. I do. I think in the same way that it's been an amazing journey for me and for me and Lindsay together to go through this, like as a team, as a couple. Bailey and Zoe were born like, you know, 5 years post IPO. I know that's a weird sort of timeline, but that's really when our life changed. Before that, we didn't, you know, I worried a lot about money. I still worry about money. Growing up, you know, money still plays an emotional role to me. And I mentioned the role modeling stuff. We have this wonderful role model named John, who's been in our lives now for 5 or 6 years, who's helped us think about philanthropy and think about, you know, legacy and all that. But John is what he would refer to as non-dynastic, meaning John's worth, you know, like many, many billions of dollars, and John's children will not inherit that. And he's a model for them. I mean, there's a way for him, there's a way for his children to access some funding, particularly for businesses that they want to build. And his kids, we've got a chance to know them, are these incredibly ambitious, brilliant, hardworking kids, incredible character.
And they saw his son yesterday at the park.
So you can go and pitch John on investing in, as his child, in their businesses, and he'll consider it if it's a good business plan, but they're just not going to get the money. We have other friends who are third or fourth generation, you know, people with means whose great grandparents made money, you know, in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and now they're benefiting from it. And so we're trying to kind of get a sense of, so who does what and how do they do it? And then we sort of cherry pick the things that we like. And I don't know if non-dynastic or dynastic is the way we're going to do it, but the one thing that does matter is this high care, this idea of gratitude that our kids are, they know that they're polite and they're courteous and they're respectful and they're hardworking and is super independent. And that means that even where our kids were very small and we're fortunate to have help at home, they bring their dishes to the sink, even since they were like, as soon as they can walk, because that stuff matters.
Bailey's been making her bed all week, actually, yeah. Because I think you had a conversation with her about that.
Yeah.
She's very proud. And actually, I read a study recently that people who make their beds are more likely to, what was it? Be successful.
And it's very Jocko, like that. Very Jocko Willink of you. Or I don't know, like one of those people. But we've tried to create a household and create a family that, you know, they know they can look around, they can see how we live, and they know that, you know, they're fortunate. But I was a public school kid in South Florida. I was the shortest and probably the poorest kid, you know, in my class in South Florida. And that created a chip on my shoulder. And I think that I don't necessarily resent that chip on my shoulder. I think it's created a lot of motivation, a lot of great ambition. So I don't want my children to worry about money the way that I did growing up, but I also don't want them to not worry at all about it, because I think it does build real character. And then on the philanthropy side, I mean, that's what like is really exciting to do with the kids, because, you know, we could actually, if you think about the transaction of like, if you work hard and things work out, you get money. And then with that money, you get to do all this really cool stuff. Bringing our kids through the process. We built something in Ottawa, and we left Ottawa. We live in Montreal now, but we moved out of Ottawa. Lindsay and I built the Finkelstein Chabad Jewish Center. The reason we built the Finkelstein Chabad Jewish Center is because this rabbi, this like young rabbi named Chaim Boyarsky, this wonderful man, when we were students, we would go to his house. He didn't have a building, so he would invite students to his house for the Sabbath, for Shabbats, and for high holidays. And Lindsay and I spent time with him, and we were just random students, but he was so kind to us. And we one day told him that if we ever could afford to do so, we'd love to help him build a real synagogue, real Jewish community center. We got a chance to do that. And when we bought the building, and when our name went up on that building, it didn't feel like a flex. It felt truly emotional. And we brought our kids along on the journey for that. And so that's one of the ways that we try to explain to our kids that, you know, I think with great power comes great responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Our kids have quite different personalities. I mean, they're sisters. They have a lot in common. But, you know, our older daughter in particular, she's very intense. And when she wants something, she's like, she's very strategic. And she's like, okay, I have to do this and this and this and this. And she did a fundraiser recently. Her school was participating in a fundraiser, and she personally was raising money as a representative of her class. And so she came home and said, we're doing this fundraiser in my class. I was really proud of this. I don't know if you remember, but she came home and she said, I'm doing a fundraiser in my class. And so I want to call Bubby Judy, who's my mother, and I want to call Bubby Merle. And she's like, I want to call all our family members, and I want them to commit to some money. because it's really important. And she explained what it was about. It was to provide education for children that could not otherwise receive an education. And then I told her, I said, well, I'll pledge some money. And then I think I said I would give her $50 or something. And then she said, well, why not 150? And I just thought it was so perfect. It was so brilliant. Like, she's so ambitious. I really appreciated how ambitious she was about it. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I was at a sort of retreat with a bunch of other parents who've also done well. And they were asking themselves the question of, hey, do I want my kids to have the same chip on my shoulder that I had? Or do I want them to just be more content? And not that there's a, not that these are mutually exclusive, people can be both, but sometimes maybe there's a little bit of a tension at some points. And they were reflecting, hey, because somebody that had their kids perhaps late in their journey, and they were saying, hey, I think it's likely that they're just going to be more content and maybe not as ambitious as I was, and that's okay. Or some people were upset about it, but it's a constant question for folks.
And we have, you know, some of these mentors that we have that are sort of third generation people of means. In some cases, they're like, you know, third gen, very ambitious, super hardworking, incredible, you know, self determination and this incredible, you know, creativity and this like joie de vivre, this like love of life. And others are not like that. They've never had, like, they have means, but they didn't work for it. And so it doesn't feel like it's theirs in the same way. So I don't think there's any one model that works. There are people that, you know, have had billions of dollars for three generations that are completely miserable. And there are others that are completely fulfilled. And it really depends on the parenting. You know, where we live here in Montreal, the top floor is sort of my office floor. And I spend a bunch of my time at the Montreal Shopify office, but I work from home a couple of days a week as well. And I love when my kids come up and either they see me working, or I also sort of very hobbyist, but I also DJ, and I have my DJ studio in my office as well. And so if I'm working and I'm at my computer, they'll come and see what I'm doing and they'll watch me like I'm on Slack or I'm drafting something or I'm recording a video, and Bailey and Zoe be like, hey, can I do that too? And then sometimes I'm DJing and they'll bring one of the stools over from one of the chairs and they'll jump up and Bailey and Zoe will start DJing as well. And it's the perfect, to me at least, it's the perfect visual representation when I stand back of watching. Like, it is not what you say, it is what you do. You can say 1,000 times to be grateful and to appreciate the stuff and to work hard. It's not that. Children, in at least in my view, and this is like, you know, N=2, because we only have two kids, they emulate what they see. And when they see the way that we treat each other, the way that we care for each other, the way that, like, the amount of attention we put into like philanthropy or to our work. You know, when Bailey was born, Lynn's opened up an ice cream shop. It's called Sunday School, this amazing ice cream shop. Zoe was too young, but I used to take Bailey on like a Saturday to Lindsay's ice cream shop. And we'd walk in the door and there'd be Lindsay. It was a really well-known, very like famous ice cream shop in Ottawa. So we'd walk in, there'd be a line at the door, and we'd watch Lindsay like scooping ice cream and at the cash register. And you can see Bailey's face, one, realizing that like, I can do cool shit too. I can be like my dad and do the tech thing and DJ thing. I can be like my mom and have an ice cream company, or be a psychotherapist. But watching Bailey, watching Lindsay doing her craft and building this ice cream company, I thought was like, there's nothing I could have said to her. There's no movie or book or any type of visual representation I could have given her that would have been more accurate and more impactful than her seeing Lindsay running her business. And I think, I don't know, I think that's the way we've been doing it. We don't parent by, you know, by legislative creed. We parent by actions and by demonstrating what we think is good values.
By example, yeah, it's well said. I want to, this is a great sort of overview on how you guys think about some of the parenting stuff. I want to end by focusing on the longevity and durability of your guys' relationship. You know, some people can find a person and have this great honeymoon period, but not every couple can last, you know, decades, right? And you talked earlier about grandparents, 75 years, 70 plus years, it's incredible. What advice do you have for other couples who are, you know, 5, 10, 15 years in, or saying, hey, this isn't the same as it once was, or we're having real difficulties, or what have you learned, either practices or ideas or mindsets around how to make something great for the long hauler, how to make it even better as more time goes on.
Yeah, I think one thing that I would say is really important is to not let resentment build. So if there's something that you're not happy about, you have to say something. You either have to accept it. So there's a practice in psychotherapy called radical acceptance. So you either have to practice radical acceptance and just be okay with it and move on and not let that negative energy consume you. Or you need to talk about it. You need to go to your partner and say, hey, this is not okay. We need to figure out a path forward. And I think, you know, in a lot of the relationships that I've seen that haven't worked, they stopped communicating. You know, they stopped talking about the things that were bothering them. And I think they maybe thought that they had accepted certain things, but they hadn't. And that comes out in other ways. It comes out in, you know, affairs, and it comes out in, you know, not spending time living separate lives. And so I think, yeah, it's really important to talk about, you know, what do you need from your partner? You know, bring up the things that are not okay for you and let your partner know, hey, this is not okay. I do it all the time. It drives Harley crazy, but I don't care because I am not going to let the negative energy consume me and then resent my partner. That's terrible.
Yeah, I guess we're already past the point of personal stuff, so might as well share it. But yeah, I mean, I get texts from Lynn's, you know, on a weekly basis about something that I did that she did not like.
Not
maybe not weekly, but every couple of weeks. I will get something, and you're like, I really did not like that. I did not like the way, I didn't like your tone, and like what you said there. And I think in the moment, you're like, oh, this is like the last thing I need right now. Like, I'm trying to do a million and one things, and like, now also, like, Lynn's is mad at me for this. I have to do, you know. But I think what it does is, it is a pressure release valve. You unrelease the pressure when you do things like that. It may not feel great at the time, but it actually allows the pressure not to mound. And I do think you do get to a point where the pressure, like, you know, it's like the trust battery, right? Like, if you do what you say you're going to do and you act a particular way, the way that, you know, you want to, the trust battery gets really full. And hopefully you keep it full. And, you know, when I mess up, trust battery goes down a little bit and then I try to bring it back up. But like an old cell phone battery, eventually the trust battery, and I think the tension battery, you know, gets to a point where it cannot be recharged again. The trust battery gets so low that, again, like an old cell phone, you can't recharge it. It's dead. Mm-hmm. And I think the goal is to never let it get anywhere near that point. For me, like, I think ritual is really important. I mean, what do we do Friday night?
What did we do Friday night? Yeah. Oh, yeah, we went out with our friends.
Went to a dance club.
And it was...
Which, like, really fun. Like in her 40s.
Definitely not the usual activity.
Definitely not. Like, Lindsay and I went to a dance club with our best friends, another couple who were our best friends. And, like, went to a dance club. We were by far the oldest ones there. And it wasn't, like, this, like, fancy thing where, like, we had, you know, a section where we, like, randomly walked in to a random dance club. And we danced to, like, I don't know, 1 o'clock in the morning. It was spontaneous, but Lindsay and I both loved to dance, and it was really fun. And it sort of felt like, you know, like, I don't know, maybe that's a new ritual now that every 4 weeks we go to a dance club. But creating this ritual, I think, is really important. The second thing I'm going to say is, this is for anyone who's watching who also, you know, is like running a business that, you know, whether it's a large scale company or a small scale company, I'm really proud that we have, like, I think this idea of like work-life balance as a separational thing is complete bullshit. You know, Bezos talks about work-life harmony. He talks about that more from a time management perspective, but I think you could actually talk about it from a incorporation perspective. We have probably 4 or 5 executive offsites a year at Shopify where the exec team, we get together. Half of those, 2 or 3 of those a year at least, are with our spouses. We bring our spouses with us. So I know that sounds like a weird thing, like it's an offsite, why bring it? It's because, like, Shopify is all consuming for all of us, for everyone that works at the company, it's all consuming. And so it's important that, like, Lindsay knows what's going on. She, you know, we have a pretty new executive team now in the last couple of years. Like, it's important she knows who the people I'm spending 90% of my waking hours with, and that she meets their spouses. And having that type of dynamic, this idea of incorporation, as opposed to, well, this is Lindsay world and this is Shopify world, as much as possible, we've incorporated it into this wonderful, harmonious life. And I think that has been incredibly helpful. I think this idea of separating those two, and not to say that that's right for everyone, but for me, that's been really, really valuable. But if I look at my grandparents,
I think ritual has been absolutely incredible for them, that they have these things, those little drives, random, everyone gets flowers for Valentine's Day. Like, you know, flowers on a random Tuesday means a lot more, a little gift, a small thing. I'm going to, like, you know, it's cooking dinner spontaneously. Those things, like those little moments in aggregate, add up to real life. And I don't know, that's sort of what we've been focused on. So I don't know, more dance clubs, I guess.
More communication. And actually, I think it's not just what you say, it's how you say it. You know, if you want to address a concern with your partner and you go at them by attacking them, that's not going to end well. I think that it's really important that you choose your words carefully and that you choose the right timing also. Like if I tried to talk to Harley in the middle of earnings, that would be stupid. You know, I wouldn't do it that way. You have to pick the right moment.
Yeah, that's well said. I ask this of every couple. This is a great place to wrap, but just because we have 3 minutes left, is there anything we haven't got to that you feel like would be beneficial to our audience that's top of mind? If not, we can wrap on that great bow, but just wanted to create the space for it in case anything came to mind.
If we plotted out specifically on like mentorship as relates to relationships, we've sort of plotted out, I think, everything that we've learned from all these different couples. There isn't necessarily one thing that works. We have a couple very close with who the age gap is like 30 years and they're a wonderful couple, but you know, they met in very different times of their lives. We have another couple who, you know, they're actually not technically married, but they're as close as can be and they have children together. Some, you know, travel all the time together. Some travel separately. There isn't any one of these like beautiful silver bullet of like, if you do this, mm-hmm. your relation will be great. So I think it's dangerous to try to create these like pithy memes about relationships. I actually think figuring out your own version, your own rhythm. Like if you know that you and your partner, your spouse, your special someone would have a good time going to a nightclub or, you know, closing down a small restaurant for you and your friends or cooking dinner, you know, in the forest and doing like some sort of camping trip like that. Like, I think people talk about self-awareness. I think this is concept of like couple awareness that like, mm-hmm. if you know who you are and you have a good self sense of self and sense yes. of the other person.
Yes. Of yourself and of the other person.
That's right.
It's really important. Like you know, to quote Brené Brown, you have to show up as your authentic self. That's kind of the first part of being in a really good relationship. But then there's also this other aspect of, you know, understanding your partner's authentic self and meeting them where they're at, knowing what's important to them and being able to compromise when it's needed. But, you know, figuring out like what is the best path forward for our authentic selves together.
Yeah, I think this idea, I love that point because like there's this beautiful balance of acceptance, but also holding each other to a higher standard. Hmm. I think Lindsay wants me to be a better version of me without me changing who I am. I'm pretty alpha. I'm pretty like type A. She's not going to like change that. But the way that I show up sometimes is not the right way. And so she reminds me of a better version of myself or a better version of who I want to be. And I think that is probably...
I think you do that for me too.
Yeah. I think that's probably the thing that is universal across all of these relationship role models we have, that there's an acceptance of who that person is deep down, but there's also an expectation that like they requalify. And I want to requalify to be Lindsay's husband next year. To do that, there has to be some growth. And I can't just show up the way I do now. And I think I don't say that as a chore. I say that as maybe as a romantic challenge.
All right, I'll let you know how you do.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd like a scorecard.
That's an inspiring note to end on. Lindsay and Harley, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with me and the Modern Relationships audience.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is fun.
This is
a very, very unique concept for a podcast, Eric. I don't know. I think I love it. I guess we'll see. But I think this is very cool.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Modern Relationships. Please make sure you're following on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. If you have a chance, leave us a review or comment on this episode to let me know who else you'd like to hear from on this show. Modern Relationships is a podcast from Turpentine, the network behind Econ 102, Upstream, and Turpentine VC.